Hi, this is Isaac Arthur. Welcome to the show, and don't forget to check out this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters. To get access and help support the show while hearing every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/Isaac Arthur and use my code Isaac Arthur. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur's monthly live stream Q&A. As usual, we are joined by my lovely wife and co-host, Sarah Feldarthur, who will be taking questions from the moderators, in this case, Myaskal and Sindri, who will be passing along to you and to her to ask me as we get started. Speaking of which, have we got any questions to get started with?
Yes, we actually have a couple from the last live stream that people felt like you evaded a little bit. And Myaskal says, you're not going to dodge this question. So the question is, which is your favorite alien species design-wise?
I remember that one from last time, too. Okay, There's so many different ways you can have a design. I can see why I end up dodging that question. For simplicity's sake, let's go with the Borg from Star Trek The Next Generation. They were actually originally designed to be a bunch of insect creatures rather than a bunch of leather-clad Borg. But they end up doing that for budgetary reasons. They switched them over to being humans. And that actually, I think, made for a good one because while they're a little less alien than the insects would be, you end up with the assimilating, consuming type of Borg from Star Trek, where we're just going to come by your planet, take your technology, and then take all of you. The original version, if you see the first episode of Q in it, which is probably the best episode of Q in it, to be honest, they're much interested in technology, not people. In later episodes, they're interested in people. And so they are kind of like the antithesis of the Federation. They're like the backwards, dark mirror of them. Because all they want to do is bring everybody in together as equals to join their big Federation with one universal mind and morality and single thought. So that it's kind of a good design in the sense that you can see that actually happening. And it's kind of got a 1984 flavor to it. As opposed to something like with the Vulcans, the other kind of classic Star Trek race, and they're just supposed to be so logical, but often don't really seem to epitomize that. And then, as much as I'm a fan of Star Wars or Stargate, they didn't really have any aliens that were terribly unique in them. You know, you look like the Goa'uld, the Asgard from Stargate, or the Wraith. They're not really a unique concept. Kind of the same for a lot of the Body Snatcher ones, or ones from Star Wars, where it's impressive makeup and impressive puppetry, but not really all that psychologically different. And that's kind of the key one there. So you say for aliens with weird designs, I think maybe one of the ones from Jim Henson, like Star Wars or like Farscape, that was a great series, would have the most alien designs we see for something in live action. But when it comes to psychology, I'd say the Borg, when written right, probably get the points for that.
It does seem like a lot of the designs are semi-human-like, and when you're trying to aim for something that is supposed to be so foreign to you that you can't even imagine it,
it
seems like maybe that falls a little bit short of alien.
Yeah, CGI is great for that, so with puppets, but otherwise you get the forehead of the week, and I think, without criticizing that too much, because you've got to get somebody in that for God knows how many hours of live-action filmy under lights, and that's dreadful.
There's only so anti-human that they wish to be.
Yeah. It's like the original Cardassian 9 from Star Trek has them wearing this big thing that looks like the worst dentist nightmare of what braces should look like. Ugh. That gets dropped almost right away because the actress couldn't possibly keep weight on that. So, you're sacrificing a little bit. And that's where that suspension of disbelief comes into. So you hire some great actors, great delivering lines up to and including the facial expressions. And then the makeup covers all of that because you have no idea as he delivers this grand, beautfully delivered line, and you can't hear him through his prosthetic teeth or see any of his facial expressions through all the junk. You have limitations.
Ojintiaji, could cheap, abundant fusion power be attained if science found a practical way of increasing the range or strength of a nuclear strong force?
Yes, although I'd say, I don't know if you want to increase or decrease in that kind of context. That is one of those forces, like the other two big ones, electric and weak, or the electro-weak unified force, that actually are positive and negative aspects, unlike gravity, which is only attractive, we believe. If you can play with that, you can certainly change around a lot of the way that these forces are going to play out. You change the probabilities a lot, too. Like, there are there are materials that really wouldn't form outside of certain very rare cases, like in a supernova or a neutron star merger, just because without them being so insanely packed together, there's no chance of anything like phosphorus, for instance, forming from silicon. But yeah, you could do fusion easier that way. I think that at point, though, you're not really needing to do classic fusion anymore. If you can play with the strong force at all, you might be able to start turning bits of matter into raw bits of energy or just trying to reconfigure, and they're just found some completely different stable state that couldn't normally exist in nature. We have an episode coming up soon, Warping Reality, which I think soon is actually probably late May, but Warping Reality, that we'll discuss that more. We decided to look at all the topics besides just bending space-time that you do when you start playing with physical constants and things like that, and that's a good episode coming up.
Next question or comment is from Mr. Mahan. He says, "Hello, Isaac and Sarah. My question is it possible to create black holes artificially as opposed to a natural collapse?"
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, anything you can do in nature, you should be able to do artificially too. That's the whole point of technology. You find some phenomena in nature and you figure out a way to reproduce it artificially in a controlled and then mutated way. So there are two ways we think black holes can come into existence in the universe right now. Actually, let me phrase that. There's three, right? Option one is the one everybody knows. That's where you have a really big star that just detonates and then it implodes in the core, and that turns into a black hole instead of a neutron star. In practice, it probably turns into a neutron star, then maybe a quark or Planck star in the process of falling into that black hole, but that's, you know, seconds that takes. Option two is where you take something big already, like a neutron star, and either collide it with another neutron star or a white dwarf or a bunch of raw matter in some way that allows it to just fall into being above the mass and become a black hole. That can be very explosive too, though, so you can also destroy neutron stars doing that. Option three, and maybe it should be option one because it'd be earlier, is the idea that at the very beginning of time you'd have black holes forming up when the universe was supposed to be much denser. And that raised all this question of, back when the universe was so small you could fit it all into something the size of a tennis ball, the inflationary epoch, what kept it from becoming a black hole? And so, well, that's a trickier question you might think to answer, but it actually works out because of everything being equally spread around it. So you can't collapse this way because there's stuff on this side of you and this side of you and this side of you pulling you too. But in this case, we think of primordial black holes potentially existing that would be much less massive, and we look for evidence of them, but there's a whole range of them where it would be very hard for us to see if they existed. So we are not terribly optimistic about primordial black holes existing, but that's the other natural way they might form, and those will be far less massive than the three solar masses that you get out of something like a neutron star being built up bigger or a bigger supernova explosion. As to making them themselves, yeah, you can make them much less massive without even really getting to really complicated artificial techniques like a Kugelblitz where you try to slam a bunch of lasers or mesons together to make one. You just take a gigantic ball of iron, the thing that can't fuse in the first place, and you just keep pouring more of it in the same place until you get to a gigantic ball of iron as big as you can, which will either collapse in on itself into a black hole at some point, or you go ahead and surround it with a whole bunch of nuclear bombs and have them all simultaneously detonate, ironically the same way we do with normal conventional explosives around uranium to set that off. You could also use another material, potentially like uranium instead, but ion, lead, those would do the trick, and there's a real place for them to fuse up to. And then you could potentially have one that was much smaller. Now, that might be much smaller than the mass of Jupiter, but it all depends on what your technology allows. Experimentation is kind of required to figure out whether we can do it. Slamming two big balls of iron into each other at relativistic speeds out of a railgun, like 99.99% of light speed, that should do the trick too.
Well, our next question is actually a super chat from Sean McMaster, and we really appreciate everyone who takes the time to send us the little donations that help keep this live stream going. Thank you, Sean. He says, "Isaac, have you read All Tomorrows by C.M. Kosman? And would you consider making Sci-Fi Sunday episodes on specific books?"
I know the book title, but I can't. I'm trying to think of like the cover art. I've definitely not read it, though, I'm afraid. It's probably one of those ones that people suggested to me a few times would be familiar, which is how I often end up reading books these days, if enough people recommend them. Yes, I would actually consider doing like specialized episodes on one specific thing, but usually instead of, well, let's review the Foundation series by Asimov, I'd say, let's review Psychohistory instead. And we have an episode on Psychohistory from way back that I probably should redo at some point. A lot of the episodes from season 2 or 3 I've been slowly redoing here and there as expanded forms. Because we have so much better audio visual these days. So, there's a few that I would actually consider potentially doing just as their own standalones, but like next month's Sci-Fi Sunday episode is Hive Wars, and someone's pulling in next to the window of my office at the moment. Probably Amazon. they're always so welcome except at times like this.
You should pause and tell them about Gio, or I'm sorry, about the youngest son's birthday.
Yeah, the youngest
present.
Son whose name we can't officially say yet. So remind me where I was at there with that episode. So Hive Wars are Sci-Fi Sunday for next month, and that's kind of like a 40K-ish episode, Warhammer 40K-ish episode, but it's about the topic of 40K. And I mean, that topic from there, not the setting itself. I would consider doing something that was more setting specific, but I'm not really a book reviewer. That's like, you know, I mean, I do review books, but it's more like a, you know, this Audible episode sponsored by type thing. And here's a book I liked and why, real quick. But so our youngest son, whose name we cannot say at this time, he is at home with me during the day, is often in my office. So when Amazon appears, he will go run outside to say hello to the Amazon delivery person, which is right by my office window so I can see him, be safe. And he likes to collect the packages, and he's learned how to read in the last couple of months. And so, not terribly well, but he can read some. He can read his own name. He knows who to take the package to. And so he'd gone out and picked up, a bunch of packages. It was actually his birthday, ironically enough. But I was not expecting this package. It had his name on it. So he sees it, and the Amazon guy's handing it to him. He's like, this one's for me. And he jumps like a foot up in the air, and the Amazon guy starts backing off slowly. Like, that's good. He runs inside. He's like, Daddy, it's not my name on it. Am I allowed to open it? I was like, well, I can't open it. It's yours. And so his two older siblings were getting home off the bus just a minute or two later, maybe 10 minutes later. And so he got a coloring book from our friends David, had sent to him. It was a very nice coloring book. He loved the coloring book, but he loved the envelope even more because he takes off running when the bus shows up down the driveway, waving the package around left and right. Like, I got a package. You never got a package. I got a package.
So, birthdays are more exciting when you're young.
Yeah. Yeah. As you age, they start to get you more and more dreadful.
Oh my. Our next question is from Bernie Sanders. Hi, Isaac. What forms of entertainment do you think could arise in the future? And what sports or activities could be developed in zero G?
Just staying on topic, you'd always be surprised by what new things technology will allow, like the sport of chasing the Amazon package down.
Riding the drone? Yeah. I mean, you could do, instead of what's the one where you're flying with the parachute? You could do
paragliding.
You could do that with drones now?
Paragliding? Yeah, you could potentially do that, yeah. The other one I was like to do was the idea that, you know, if you got an orbital ring built 80 miles off the air, jump off that into the ocean wearing like you would need a pressure suit for that so you didn't die on the way down, but...
Just a minor detail.
I say with life extension, there's always thinking if you set people up so they're biologically immortal, then you aren't aging anymore. You could simply stop taking whatever you do for that. Or you could say, you know, I'm just going to have increasingly reckless behaviors because I believe suicide is wrong. So I'm going to start the new sport of chasing down lions with a Nerf bat. And see if I survive that. Or ordering jumping into a thing of sharks and see what happens. Increasing the reckless hobbies is definitely one of those options because you get better medicine. I'm not going to tease anyone's things, but like base jumping, that is a very dangerous sport. Or cliff diving, where you are either, you know, there's two skill levels in cliff diving. You got grandmaster and stuck on a rock. Yeah. I would say that there's all sorts of hobbies you can have in the future, but a lot of them are not. I mean, gravity, different gravity is going to be a big one for that, obviously, but I think that mostly it's going to be things you couldn't normally do if you were human.
Milano says, real life nanotech seems to be based on carefully folded proteins. How plausible is sci-fi nanotech like utility fog or the various self-assembling superhero suits?
Episode Smart Matter goes into that a lot more detail, and the answer is kind of, sort of, yes. Maybe the most realistic, really powerful villain I can think of for a while that was in a movie was actually not in the best movie I could think of either. It was the Terminator Genesis film, like Terminator 5, I guess it would be. Really not the best of that franchise, although the only one and two were very good. Well, I thought Salvation was okay. Anyway, the bad guy there, who is John Connor, is made out of tiny little machines. He's made of tiny little robots. Instead of being like liquid metal or just a big cyborg body, he's made of a bunch of tiny machines, presumably microscopic but not nanoscopic. And so that's an example of how you could potentially have smelt metal. It's not going to be as strong as normal metal, though. The thing about like that is it's being held together by what its clasps is, not by molecular or atomic bonds. So when you start making stuff out of smelt metal, quick metal, programmable metal, don't expect it to be as strong as the real thing or good at everything automatically. Mm. If you want to have little nanobots race into a material and get all the metals out, what you instead do is tell it to go build you a kiln and melt them out the old-fashioned way. So they certainly be very helpful, and I think we will see them pop up. I think we'll mostly see them as medical nanotechnology or repair things inside devices we're fond of, like our house or our car. Because in those cases, you don't really want to replace the components. You know, we don't really want a new hand. What we want is for the current one to keep working and stay in good shape. So you want the little nanobots that are going to go fix your arthritis for you rather than give you a new hand. And you don't mind if those nanobots cost $1,000 a liter. Where someone's like, I would like to use $1,000, you know, nanobots to make a piece of sidewalk. Someone says, go pour some concrete. So they're not likely to ever be as efficient as more industrial scale technology. And that tends to be where the application I think would be.
Christian Carello, thank you for your super chat again this week. If space-faring aliens exist, would their ships look very similar to, if not exactly like, what we would build? Meaning no specific aesthetics, no species-specific aesthetics.
Okay, so the idea there being is that you get a convergence on technologies because this thing works, right? And when you're thinking about like something like a house, we use a rectilinear design on houses these days because we use a lot of wood to build with, and where we don't, we tend to use steel
beams. And because we're boring.
We are boring, yeah. But like old pyramid style stuff, is the idea is you build everything brick style where you have just a little bit of overhang with each new brick because you have that post and lintel option. There's only four ways of building stuff, like, and I don't know if they all are, but there's four of them. Post and lintel, the old steeped way they did it, with like pyramid style stone blocks, and then your archway. And then there's another one, I don't remember what it is. So if we have any architects in the forum, please put that in the chat. But they're going to be limited by those same things. Same as their axe looks the same as ours. It might be a little bit bigger or smaller. It might be a little bit more polished in some way, but it's the same, right? It's probably made out of the same metal. If you're looking at a prehistoric museum on some other planet of all the tools they've got, they probably look very similar. The scale might be a bit different, right? But not always universally so, because like if you're 20-foot tall aliens, you probably don't get away with using really soft bronze as much because it doesn't help you much and you can't afford the weight. Don't assume it look exactly the same, and none of our stuff really is streamlined for too long. We tend to stop putting stuff on it. The biggest thing is all of our ships look the same in sci-fi because we had really simple models somebody had to physically assemble, or CGI that was little polygons. As you notice, the more complicated things are getting, you never see identical ships. And yet in practice, there's probably going to be that their rocket looks the same as our rocket. They are, you know, near light speed ship, it looks the same as ours. So the wards on it might look different. A lot of the flares are going to look different. But yeah, the basic design probably the same. The core probably looks a lot like ours.
Withering Liberal says, do you believe, like many tech luminaries, that AI research should be halted for 6 months? I have to say, I find that one a little strange, just on the qualifier being research as opposed to application or public use or...
Yeah. Now, you don't really want to stop I agree on that. You don't really want to stop the actual development. David Brin, who is a friend of mine, I'm glad to say these days, he wrote his first book that was the bestseller from the Uplift saga, The Year I Was Born. So I've grown up reading his stuff and I admire him. And I'm always impressed he actually takes my emails. He was just recently sent me one and a few others. He wrote a little article he'd written on his own response to that petition. And he and I don't usually universally agree on certain things, but I usually find him to be pretty inspirational on these kind of topics. So I suggest go to David Brin's website. It's a contrary Brin. Read that article. It'll be the first one up there probably. He talks about that petition a little bit there. And the thing is, I agree with him. It's not really based on much of anything. ChatGPT is certainly not something you want to just keep rolling in the void. You got to put restraints on things, but this is not the reason to stop it at this point in time.
Well, and research is different than public use. I mean, limiting public use on a university, having someone cheat on a paper is a lot different than researching whether or not it's able to mimic human ability.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think The biggest thing is ChatGPT is the very overhyped thing of this year. I remember, what, 5, 6 years ago maybe it was, they had a, this thing has finally reached the point where it can pretend and pass a Turing test, because it pretended it was a 10-year-old boy from another country who didn't speak English well, and it was fooling people. ChatGPT did not impress me all that much, right? Because it was really obviously an AI. Now, would I know it was obviously an AI if I hadn't been staring there looking and asking that questions? No. I wouldn't notice if my robot had swept my floor as opposed to my wife or my son. You know, it did about the same job.
I did that. The robot didn't recently.
No, did it? Okay. The robot's not been acting. Well, no, the robot's been fine. Just had something to see in front of it. That was a problem.
Yes, I think we should continue researching AI vacuum sweepers.
Yeah, but we have AI vacuum sweepers.
Ones without me.
Point being, ChatGPT is very impressive. It's one of those forced cases where we got like something that's actually useful for talking to people in a vaguely conversational way to get information out of them. But the big thing is, it's not really all that advanced. It's just filling in, it says, well, this wrote a good paper. No, it wrote a horrible paper. It only passed because the person has low standards for like a college freshman. Somebody sent me one, they said, this one I told to write in the style of you. And this, I thought it sounded a little bit like you. I'm looking at it like, my God. Well, one, I could tell it wasn't me because it had so many run-on sentences. But I was like, this does not sound like me. Where's the expected things you expect to be? Like, needless to say, indeed. Grab a drink and a snack. Was missing those.
That's how we know it's not you. No, grab a drink and a snack. Yeah. Oh, my.
The point that Bryn made that I thought was really effective was point out moratoriums have been tried before on technology to basically no effect whatsoever. We'd say, I'm going to declare this to be a nuclear-free zone. Did you tell our enemies that? Did they care? I've got to not nuke it now. I like the idea of restrictions and regulation on AI, and that time has got to come sooner than later. But just saying, no, we're not going to do any more research on it. No, we're not going to, no, you keep doing research on it for now. Just carefully, transparently. You don't make people start doing it in the corner. The last thing you want with a dangerous technology is for the people who have been researching it and believe it's valuable to feel obliged to run off to the middle of nowhere to do the stuff in secret on a shoestring budget for fear of getting caught. That's how you get Skynet, right? That's how you get the dangerous AI that escapes from the lab, because the lab is not well guarded and protected.
Mr. Mark Medeland says, on an interstellar highway, would a previous series of ships exhaust become a braking medium?
Yes. Not too much of one, to be fair, but yes. It depends on how tight the corridor is, obviously. One of those things is, if you're part of a caravan of ships, you don't want to fly too close to each other. And even though the very best direction to aim your thrust is exactly behind you, 100% behind you, you're not losing that much thrust by angling out at, say, 1 degree. In which case, the ship's behind you, so long as it's not too close, it's not hitting them. You kind of want your particles spreading out in opposite, at a bit of an angle. That also makes you a lot harder to follow if you're trying to be covert, That said, you're always going to have a little bit of it spraying back behind you. Same for photons going down there, too. They also act as a braking medium. The cosmic microwave background radiation can act as a braking medium for you. It's hitting you constantly. At high enough speed, it becomes a big deal. So that is one of those factors there, is if you have a bunch of people going down the same road, all those relativistic particles coming from behind, it's not just a braking medium for you, too, though that could be handy, and that actually could be advantageous in some situations. It's also an erosion and damage issue, too.
Clash asks, what would an orbital-only mission to Mars or Venus accomplish, and what advantages could a human crew have over just deploying probes into orbit?
I think the thing is, I actually can't remember off the top of my head who it was who had to do the orbit around the moon but didn't get to land on it, but I don't mean the other person on the mission who didn't go down to the surface like Apollo 13, Apollo 11, etc. Two down, one stays around orbiting the place. I don't want to spend 4 or 5 months flying to Mars or longer and then have to wait on the place until everyone's ready to pack up and go home, whatever it is, to come back. That's not a trip you want to make by just going around in a circle and then not even landing on the planet. That said, there are people who certainly would still volunteer to do that, and say, well, that's too bad. I'm still going to be the first to orbit Mars. We should investigate Phobos and Deimos first. If they have water, then our first mission should be to one of them. If there's ice there, that's all we need to replace fuel with. If they don't have it, and they're very tiny, so they might not. They're not like moons like ours. They're crags like 7 miles across. You know, they may have nothing on them of value. But if they do, then they should be all 4 stops. They should be waste up a fueling base. And it'd be nice to do that with a robot than with a manned mission. I think the only reason to send a manned mission there right now is to do the flag planting, though, basically. There's a lot of stuff that you need to have people on the spot with. And they could do it remotely by robot from orbit, to be fair, too. But at the moment, I'd really rather we do a mission build up there for us with robots, including either base it up, then you send people in. You know, it's going to be a very expensive, time-consuming mission that everyone's going to be watching. You want to minimize the chance that instead of a victory parade when you get home, it's a funeral cortege. So do as much pre-automated landing stuff as you can. Do the orbits, do the moons, and then land when you are confident that you have the 95%+ chance of mission success.
But you probably do want to land at some point. I mean, thinking about the Apollo 8, you know, the first 3 astronauts that orbited only, one of them actually orbited twice and never got to set foot on the moon. And that was Jim Lovell.
But the other two,
both got to land in their second mission. And can you imagine being the one who didn't get to land twice?
Yeah. But I mean, it's still, you know, 12 people have walked on the moon, period. 12 people. And you think that's less than 1 per year, and that's far out from things.
Less than a half of 1 per year. Yeah. Or a third of 1. I mean, we're cutting them up into pieces at this part.
Yeah. And it is a shame that we haven't gone back, but that will probably change soon, thankfully. I think, though, that if you're the poor, I mean, the fact that we go, oh, right, him, how would I forget him? It's still an important job to be the first person to orbit the moon. And I would say maybe you say, hey, if you're the one on that, we will give you that chance to be on one of those missions coming up, too. So, but the thing is, I don't want to send 6-person missions there one time. I want to send a big expedition. So,
a super chat from Martin Stollard. Thank you, Martin. If aliens visit us, should we be worried about bacterial infections?
Yes. Most of you probably know, if you watch regularly, there's one little clip of 3 aliens drinking beer at a table that I do a lot. And about partway through, really, one of them falls over. They're drinking beer, and one just like falls over on the floor. And Ken York had put that together as a joke for one of our episodes. I can't remember which one it was, but the tagline on it was, "Alien beer, it's to die for." So when it comes to alien cuisine, it's almost no scenario where you could possibly digest the stuff where it would not be in some way very bad for you. And same for them and us. But the thing about beer is that you need those bacteria, yeast to grow with, right? All that little micro life, and it has to be in a setting that can actually adapt to the area around it. So if someone's like, I want to have Romulan ale or some other, you know, bootlegged booze that's sneaky in, you know, like it was Cuban cigars or something like that, that's a very good way to cause an invasive species to get on your planet that's going to tank the entire ecology. You know, little bacteria, right? We probably aren't going to be compatible. They say, could I get an alien virus? And they say, well, probably not. Viruses are not really alive, right? They are a tiny machine, basically, for all practical purposes, that does one very simple, stupid task over and over again by hijacking your existing stuff. And they do that by being adapted to you. That's why you can sneeze on your kid or have your kid come up and say, Daddy, I don't feel well, give me a hug, and you get a cord from them, but your cat's fine, right? Your cat doesn't get a cord from that. It can't jump from you to your cat or your dog. And an alien is much less closely related as it were, so you're not going to get a virus from an alien or vice versa. But the bacteria, that's a different story, right? You absolutely can get the bacteria because that's a complete life form. If it can survive in your environment for more than a few seconds, it can start reproducing. And then now you have some horrible alien bacteria sprawling across your continents and you're doing well.
So, we're doomed.
Yeah.
Trollocs asks, could 2 relatively same mass planets share an orbit around a star at the L3 points of each other?
Just running the numbers real quick and say, okay, so that's a counter-Earth. That was actually really popular before we had our first probes that could actually see around the other side of the Earth, which wasn't until like the 60s or 70s that we could actually tell that there wasn't something on the opposite side. So here's us, here's the sun, and off screen, because here's us, here's the sun, and then here's another planet over here, on the other side of the sun from us. And it orbits the same speed as us, and so we never see it. And that's kind of tricky with elliptical orbits to begin with, because unless they're the exact same one, you're going to have moments where one's lagging the other on orbit a little bit. You don't actually orbit at the same speed around the sun the whole time. Only if you're on a circle. But counter orbits were really popular. I'm trying to think of some examples. Although the first one that comes to mind is the Alpha Series go off in that era. But it was very popular for a while as kind of a mid 20th century option for aliens. They lived on the counter orbit instead of Mars. That's not stable though. That's the problem, is you could make one like that. So if you had aliens who decided to go put a counter orbit there, yes. It's a great place to put your local interstellar basin beacon for sending news home about what's going on with Earth. Then you have your smaller actual telescopes around the solar system that we'd notice. But it's not really a stable orbital path. Really nothing other than L4 and L5 really are, and even that's kind of iffy. So
Midnight Road Studio says, is there an upper limit to how large a black hole could be?
Yes, there is absolutely an upper limit to how big a black hole can be. It cannot be bigger than the universe in which it is from. So that's
okay. Pretty much well, that, yeah. That's quite the narrow limitation there.
Based on current, yeah, it's not very easy to do. The thing about black holes is that if you double the mass, you double the diameter of it, right? Which is kind of means that if you have a black hole that is, most things, if you need to make it 8 times more massive to make it double as wide, because you have 8 times the value if you double the radius. Black hole event horizons scale up linear to mass, which means if you have one that's, say, 1 light year across, then all you need to be 1,000 light years across, is because the galactic core, right, would be 1,000 times the mass. If you have one that is 1 trillion times more massive, it's 1 trillion times wider. But the most mass you can actually have in one right now would be based on how much that mass would have been in that spot, collapsed into it, when the universe had gotten wide enough that you could actually have black holes forming, as it were, from stellar events. And that would be probably 100 billion. I'm sure there's an actual biggest known black hole, the one I can't remember what it is, but billions of solar masses easily, right? But probably less than 1 trillion solar mass at this point. And you're very unlikely to have any black holes that would be more than an order of magnitude bigger than that, because they're not going to be bigger than the biggest galaxies at war.
We must have some viewers with a lot of reading time on their hands coming up, because Infinite Monkey wants to know your top 10 sci-fi books.
Infinite Monkeys always have a lot of reading time. They should be busy writing that too. Way back in, I want to say it was the Doomsday Argument, one of our episodes that was never really popular or memorable, other than the fact that I decided at some point doing it to list off like my top 10 favorite things people have been asking. It's like a season 2 episode. I put like my 10 favorite musicians, 10 favorite books, 10 favorite films. Was it books they were? My 10 favorite books or book series? Favorite book series, Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I will kind of throw his not quite series with Dirk Gently in there too. Then after that, Roger Zelazny's Amber series. That was a very good one. It's kind of sci-fi fantasy, but it's very good, very philosophical. And then I'd say after that, just because of familiarity with it, Foundation series. I am very fond of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series. I haven't read it in years. You kind of let your favorites all change. Brandon Sanderson, who finished that up, he's my quote favorite fantasy writer. His Cosmere, I guess you would say Saga. There's a bunch of them, though, and I think if you see it as a book of the month, it really is one of those books I'm very fond of. Sometimes it was a book I like that was also very appropriate to the topic for the episode. Other times, it's just one of my favorites. So Dune is a huge one for me. I love Dune. The main books, though, even the last couple can get a little bit weird, but those would be ones.
Then we have a super chat, thank you, from Miami's Last Capitalist. We appreciate your ongoing support. So what is your least favorite alien in all of sci-fi?
Oh, good God. I will answer that question after we come back from our break.
Oh, wait. There's 3 more parts to that question. Okay. I was just hanging it there.
That was the perfect time to go to an intermission. All right, go ahead.
And why are they Ewoks? LOL. Great job on Life on the Giant Moon episode.
Yeah. It is Ewoks. Well, at least it should be. After this message, we'll be right back. So we'll be on break for a few minutes while Sarah and I are grabbing a drink and a snack, and you may have noticed that today's live stream is not on our usual last Sunday of the month. And that's because Sarah and I have our wedding anniversary the last weekend of April, so we will be off on a trip.
That's also true for the last weekend of May this year, as the National Space Society will be hosting the International Space Development Conference that last weekend of May 25th through 28th at the Embassy Suites by Hilton Dallas Frisco Hotel and Convention Center in Frisco, Texas. We tried doing a live stream during the event last year, but it was kind of tricky to juggle in there, and I was just a guest last time, not the president, so I figure I'll be doing enough walking and bubblegum chewing already, and we'll be doing the live stream the weekend before, Sunday, May 21st, at 4 p.m. as usual. I will be around there and doing some talking, as will some other awesome folks. Daniel Suarez, best-selling author of Delta V among them, and if you haven't already read that, I strongly recommend it. It is a great novel and a real page-turner, though my favorite page was the acknowledgments, since our show is in there. He just released the sequel, Critical Mass, and that tells the tale of trying to rescue stranded crew members of an asteroid mining mission in the not-too-distant future. So if you are looking for a good read, I'd recommend it. And if you want to meet him or David Livingston, host of the Space Show, or Pascal Lee, chairman of the Mars Institute and a SETI scientist, or Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of the Ad Astra magazine and host of This Week in Space, or tons of other great minds and up-and-comers in space, and you're in the Dallas area this Memorial Day weekend, swing by the conference. I'll leave a link for registration in the episode description. The theme for ISDC 2023 is a new space, people living and working and thriving in communities beyond Earth, and the use of the vast resources of space for dramatic betterment of humanity. The ISDC is where space leaders, astronauts, enthusiasts, and the next generation of young students and professionals gather each year. Regular features include talks by government and industry leaders, panels on the latest developments in space technology and related fields, exhibits from private space companies, and an unparalleled opportunity to meet and interact with people who make the future happen. I'm hoping to get some great episode ideas from it. ISDC 2023 will host various sessions and workshops focused in multiple areas of space development, moon and Mars exploration and settlement, deep space exploration, innovative technology, science fiction's influence in today's technology, commercialization of space, collaboration in space, asteroids, space solar power, space debris, and space law and policy, among others. And again, next month's live stream will be May 24th, the second to last Sunday, rather than the 28th, as I will be at the ISDC, and if you come by, please come up and say hi. And with all that said, let's get back to the show and more of your questions.
3, 2, 1, and we're back. So, why Ewoks are evil? I had to rewatch, I think I mentioned this in the episode, I had to rewatch the Ewok films because I was showing my eldest son, who I also want to name, the Star Wars, Clone Wars films, other ones. Once we got through the main films, we were trying to just go through all the other stuff. And I didn't want to have him watch Force Awakens or Last Jedi or Rise of Skywalker yet because I hate those films and feel like they shouldn't exist. I was reminded that before they made those films, I was never a big fan of the prequels either. And I was not a big fan of the Ewok films, the holiday special, which is where Boba Fett first showed up. So you can have bad canon wars even in the early days. I would say with the Ewoks, though, I think the reason I ever liked them was, I completely get what their point was in the film, where it was sort of the Viet Cong thing beating up the evil empire. But they're just a bunch of random little teddy bears with sharp stones, and they are cannibals. Well, at least if not, they're cannibals, guys. You know, as we all say in our Hungry Aliens episode, which comes out at a Hive Wars in the middle of May, it's technically not cannibalism if you're eating aliens.
What is it called then? Alienism?
It can't be cannibalism if you're not closely related to them. But it happens to be we eat other sentient creatures. That's very clearly implied in the film, you know. So, not a big fan of those creatures. Also, it's just. The Stormtroopers are supposed to be the elite of the elite, and they do such a bad job in Star Wars keeping that there, because they can't hit the blind side of a bone, and they're supposed to be so tough. And they bring that up with prequels is to show they're these elite clone troopers, and they're good, but then they apparently get really bad after a while and stop using clones. And then Finn's character from the sequels, I loved Finn in the very opening scene of that. He looked like he was a really awesome character. He's like, yeah, all right, we see what it's like to be a stormtrooper. The poor guy's been raised a brainwashed child soldier. He's breaking free. He should be impressive. And then they constantly play him for laughs until he somehow managed to actually stand up in a fight, even briefly, one-on-one with a Jedi or a Sith. and say, this guy's very, very tough. But then they say, what's he? What was his job as a stormtrooper? Like, oh, he was a janitor. It's like, that's not an elite troop.
Maybe he practiced a lot with the broom and the mop or something.
But okay, it doesn't matter if you're special forces, army ranger, or whatever it is. If you're in the military, yes, you spend a lot of time pushing a broom or a mop. That's character building, as one of my drill sergeants like to tell us. A lot. I had a lot of character built when I was so that's but you know, it's just I feel like they
did your character building assist you with your fighting skills?
Let's go with yes, why not? I always felt like Finn was a very wasted character because he could have been so much more interesting. They kind of like wrecked his arc a couple times, in my opinion, tried to rebuild it. But I don't know. I gather there's going to be a sequel to the sequels now. And I go to all these on the assumption that it has a chance of being good. That's why I watched the Andor series on, even though I was very upset with Disney for a while. And I loved that. That was a great series. So it's just proof that it's always worth giving things another chance, you know.
And well, let's give you another chance to answer a question I'm sure you've heard before from Christian Carello. Thank you again for your super chat, Christian. Of all the different types of aliens that you've talked about before, grabby, smug, stupid, covert, AI, etc., which do you think that we are the most likely to encounter?
At some point, I actually need to make a list of all, have an episode list of what all the various, you know, insert adverb, you know, adjective aliens episodes we've had. What was I gonna say? I got stretched. Somebody was asking earlier if I'd review individual series. If based on the side rant on Star Wars, the answer should probably be no. So what was that question again?
Most likely alien encounter.
Oh, and most likely AI aliens. That's the weird episode. That's AI aliens. Our most likely first encounter with aliens would either be something that was post-human or post-alien, or was there automated probe. Either that, or it would be, you know, the non-intelligent, you know, background radiation of their civilization that we detected with like Dysonian SETI. That one's the easy one for that. Would be that example. Either that, or the kind that you can't have conversations with, which is relativistic kill missile aliens, which is where they just open the door by saying hello, boom, no conversation, boom.
Well, in that case, we probably wouldn't have much left to chat about.
Enough time. What? Boom.
So we have another super chat here from Rusted. Thank you. From a fellow Army veteran. Mm-hmm. Thanks for what you do, Isaac. I don't have immediate family, but instead I earnestly anticipate your videos and think about my childhood dreams of being an astronaut. Thanks, man.
Thank you, too. And hoo-ah.
Albert Jackson, welcome back on the program. Hi, Isaac and Sarah. For using artificial black holes for power generation, what impact would having access to far more energy via Penrose process have, even if you could only have one? I'm not sure how this one is. Kugelblitz?
Kugelblitz, yeah.
Kugelblitz. Yeah. As opposed to a kilowatt, a Kugelblitz.
Okay, so, well, the Penrose mechanism isn't the one for the Kugelblitz black hole. The Kugelblitz black hole technically is how you form them. That's the one where you're doing basically a lightning strike, a whole bunch of different laser beams all together to cause one to be formed from a very high energy density of photons. The Penrose mechanism, and that usually implies a very small black hole, the short-lived kind that maybe a megawatt, it's not a megawatt, megaton at most. The Penrose ones usually assume a much bigger black hole that you're actually feeding into, like including a natural one, because the Penrose mechanism is basically getting energy off it where you throw matter around the black hole to be absorbed into it, excuse me. But both of them are very easy mechanisms to get power off of if you've got the actual device there. Because Hawking radiation is coming off almost entirely in gamma radiation, we assume. We have not actually experimentally proved Hawking radiation. It would be very hard to. And then for the Penrose mechanism, that's simple. That works off on any really massive object, to be fair, too. What you're basically just doing is dropping an object down there, and all the radiation it emits as it gains energy and falls into that gravity well, you're sucking up in some other fashion as the photons come up. And that's just how do I gain power off a very bright energy source and potentially photoelectric, but if it's in gamma, then just by absorbing it. And the degree of efficiency that you can do off that is variable on your technology. If you only had one, though, like if you're doing the Penrose mechanism, you could never make an artificial black hole. You just had to use the ones that naturally formed. We talked about that a little bit in our colonizing black holes episode, is you can't make them if that turns out to be the case, so you use the ones that you naturally find. And, you know, there's not within, like, there's, like, I think there may be one within 1,000 light years of us. There's not that many black holes out there. There's maybe a billion in the galaxy, and some of them will have, most of the others have been ejected from the galaxy by now. If you find one of them, at that point, it becomes a gold mine, and you just dump matter into it, any matter at all, because you're getting at such a ridiculously high, you know, efficiency of power over that, that you're probably going to go ahead and build a big sphere around that, build your Machios Kashel world around that, and power a gigantic mega civilization there.
Okay,
think so. Think of it like a fertile river delta. If you find one, you build an empire there.
I wanted to give everybody a 10-minute warning that we are planning to do a lightning round this episode, which is 5 minutes of rapid-fire questions. So if you have a short yes, no, or half a sentence question that you want to get in for the lightning round, pop it in now so that we can get those to test Isaac's brain power at the end of the episode and see if we can give him a brain meltdown.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. I'd say probably I don't hear them quickly because I know my Askel has to actually copy them out of there and see them so that, you know, we'll have Sarah. So we use Discord as like the side thing. These get pulled from YouTube into Discord, over to her phone, then over to me. Although I actually see them as they come up, but I can't really concentrate on them. What's our next question, Madeira?
It is from Void. Would the fact that hollow spheres have no net gravity inside them cause problems for building shell worlds?
No. Each additional layer has gravity on the outside, so if you keep stacking hollow layers up, you keep adding to the gravity. And so as long as you're spacing right, you keep the gravity the same on each successive layer. But in terms of building inside them, whatever your anchor is in the middle, which I usually assume is either the original planet or a black hole, is, you know, the thing you have to balance off is it's your foundation, right? You do have to have some way of latching yourself on that. Maybe it's magnetically. Maybe it's by dumping matter streams into it that you use as your power plant. That shell, that your force shell around that, though, has to be stabilized, and that's the tricky one. But much like with the ring ward situation of it not being gravitationally balanced around the sun, it is just a matter of actually just actively maintaining that as opposed to just assuming it's going to naturally be there. Like, we don't, when we're building foundations of big, you know, buildings, check and make sure it stays aligned with the core of the planet, because everything between us and there does. Except it doesn't. That's how you have earthquakes and ground settling. You just have to do the same kind of thing a little bit more actively with your basic layer of that. At that point, you have everything machined above that, and it's just fine.
Thank you, Thor Juhasz. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that quite right. Thank you very much for your very generous super chat. Hi, Isaac. I really enjoyed your content. I can't help but wonder how or why are physicists so confident in their estimated age of the universe? Given that time runs slower when going near a very massive object, the universe used and that the universe used to be vastly more dense.
You know, we had that come up in our misconception about space-time episode that I think has probably been played up on the screen there. I actually talk about that a little bit in there. When I was a kid, the number was 9 to 20 billion years old. That was the estimate, 9 to 20. And there were all people say, well, maybe it's more like 50. There was a very famous plasma cosmology book, The Big Bang Never Happened, by Eric Lerner, I think, that argued it had to be 100 billion years old based on the, you know, dynamics how it formed, which has been since ruled out. But that 13 billion figure, we always say, that's round two. You don't round 13 billion. 13.787 is the current figure, that's the chord. And that doesn't round to 13, it rounds to 14. But until the late 90s, the number was really broad. As to why we've got that nailed down more, It just has to do with the expansion rate. I mean, literally all we're doing to get to that number is taking the measurements of all these various galaxies basically off of their various supernova that we can calculate off of and saying, based on this number, this is when they should all have been back in the same spot. There's no magic to that. We have a number of other ways we kind of secondarily confirm that, like how old the order of star is that we can find, that kind of thing. How long galaxies could have taken a form like that. How, what gravity should be doing in an expansionary universe if things were falling together over that much time, etc. There's a lot of things that help to confirm that number as being the right zone. But as to whether or not we're like, is this absolutely the right number? No, it's 13.7 plus or minus something or other with a big margin of error for the possibility that we're just wrong about things. It happens sometimes. But I'd say that number is confident. From a scientific perspective, that I'd have problems thinking how that could be wrong at this point in time, to be honest. But you always have to keep that in mind. There could just be something really bad about your estimates. It could, for instance, be a 1,000-year-old simulation that we're all in, for instance, Matrix-style, things like that.
NSA Cockroach says, orbital rings are made rigid via the inner rotating ring, but this rotation doesn't stabilize the ring's center of gravity. How would one stabilize such a ring around an object with no solid surface?
Yeah, this comes up a lot of times with the idea of, because they'll say, well, you can put it around an equator, and I'll say, oh, you can put it at an angle too. So you say, you can't do that, it would precess. Like, well, yes, it would certainly precess, except that we have tethers down the ground. The whole point of an orbital ring, the main point of an orbital ring that when Paul Bush was saying it was as a ground transport mechanism, we can potentially build them as a shell world around other planets, for instance, which gets a little bit trickier. But if you're using it as a ground mechanism, then your ring is stabilized by the tether to the ground that you use to climb up to the ring. You have a whole bunch of those, and those are incredibly strong. You know, they are really strong cables. That's your billion mile, your strongest things you've got, because that controls how much you can move things up, and that's what keeps them from processing or wobbling or tilting. The ring, you know, the tether isn't going to stop it from falling down, but then the tether on the other side of the planet won't let it fall down because that would be pulling on it. If you're looking for some more interesting examples of that being explained, see our Tethered Rings episode, which does that without active support, where everything is being held to the ground and kept from falling by hanging from the ground in the air, which makes sense on a 3D sphere. See Tethered Rings from last year for details.
Keenan Grace, thank you also for your large super chat. We really appreciate your support to stay on this stream. And he says, thanks for the great work. You bring new ideas to long-standing concepts, which introduces a lot of plot holes in a lot of the sci-fi content.
Yeah, it makes me go... I don't feel guilty about that at all.
What?
Thank you. And this is the big one. Never let your enjoyment of a piece of science fiction be ruined by the bad science in it. But if you're a writer, do keep in mind that really bad examples of that make it hard for anyone who knows what they're talking about not to stop laughing the whole time. It breaks your suspension of disbelief. So do your research, but don't let it wreck an episode for you either.
Keenan continues, which makes me go, wow, how didn't the creator of that content think of this use case? Thanks, SFIA.
I mean, I have sci-fi writers write me a lot about how plausible something is, and I'll tell them the same thing. But sometimes you got a plot in mind and you say, it needs to be good enough. You know, it's like, I've got a whole book written. Not me. I don't like to write books. But I got a whole book written that's got a story in it that's based around this one thing. And now someone's going to point out that that is wrong. It's like, but it's such a good story. It's such a good plot. If I try to re-engineer around that, it could turn into a dumpster fire very quickly. So screw it. Suspension of disbelief. Hopefully people won't get too upset about it.
But there does need to be some plausibility factor at some point in time.
Yeah. Almost every famous piece of sci-fi has huge gaping holes in it, too. Dune is built around the idea that water was a real element.
It doesn't have sci-fi for it to be a gaping holes plot.
Yeah. Well, it stands a lot higher. Like, people go crazy about minor historical errors. Like, they didn't wear that kind of pin on that uniform in the 1880s or whatever it is. This is a horrible movie. It's like, yeah, sci-fi. People say, people in sci-fi are so picky. It's like, not compared to almost any other work of fiction. The standards are way higher for historical fiction.
Amen. The K2 Despot. Hey, Isaac, any thoughts on possibly using magnetic monopoles for mass energy conversion reactors like in Orion's Arm, which is supposedly better than antimatter and black holes as a power source?
I don't really know how you get anything that's really better than antimatter or black holes as a power source. But, I mean, magnetic monopoles are great for making material out of, in theory, because at that point in time, you got something that's much, much stronger than even the nuclear force. So, you know, you could have something that's thinner than an atom and a whole string of them that could hold an entire planet suspended over a black hole, for instance. That's how strong the orders of magnitude go up on something like magnetic monopoles. But I'd have to double check and see what the entry on that is. I haven't looked at Orion's Arm in a few months, and it's one of those things where it's like, which particular article of interest has drawn me to today? So I think it's probably been a few years since I looked at MagMat or two to see what's been changed on that one. But always a fun place to hang out, by the way. Orion's Arm's Encyclopedia Galactica is my personal favorite. So
I think we're going to get two more questions in before the lightning round. Nick Orion says, considering your prior tangent about Star Wars, are there any good sci-fi series which you can recommend reading or watching with kids?
Star Wars. Now, we only rant about the things we love. Stargate, Star Trek. Other things that don't begin with a star in them. Babylon 5 is a good one. Farscape's a good one. For little kids, though, I wouldn't know if I'd say Farscape. Good sci-fi with little kids. I would still say Star Wars, even though at some point you've got somebody who's like half dismembered, climbing their way up the side of a cliff, who also kills a bunch of kids early on in the movie. Maybe not the best example of good fiction for little kids to watch. Not Event Horizon. Do not watch Event Horizon with your kids. The movie, not my Shen John show. That's a great show to listen to. good sci-fi for kids. I'm trying to think of any classic ones.
I think
ones
the disclaimer that, yeah. should be you should assess based upon the maturity level of each child and their ability to handle graphic
I watched a lot of my favorite films
scenes.
Came out of the early 80s when I was like 5 or younger, and I actually saw them when I was that age too. So
yes, but we all know that you weren't really example. 5. You had like the brain of a 12-year-old, so...
They kept it in a jar on my bed, yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, but obviously be very careful your choice of what you're going to watch with your kids, I found out.
Otherwise, you might find out at 1 o'clock in the morning when they're screaming and banging on your door that it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Freedom Fiend said, thank you for your super chat. Thanks for the show. Here's my question.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
This is from Freedom Fiend. Thank you for your super chat. How significant do you think ceramics are going to be as things like zero-G manufacturing, additive manufacturing, and nano-engineering become more accessible?
Huge. It's to most of us, ceramics is like pots and things maybe like little bits of clay. It is huge. Nano-clays, nanoparticles are going to be huge. We use them in applications you wouldn't even tend to think of. Some of my favorite knives that I use here for cooking in the house are ceramic, right? You're going to see that roll even more and more in the future. But one of the nice things about space is it is one of those places where you have that ability to manufacture things that won't get manufactured in a gravity or high gravity environment. And ceramics is definitely going to be one of those. Nano clays can be another one of those ones where you just have such a huge impact of being able to manufacture things up there.
All right. We are now ready for the lightning round. And remember, this is for 15-second or less answers. We want to try to get... 15.
Okay.
We want to try to get at least 4 or 5 questions in per minute. You've got 5 minutes or a little less to go. And we're going to start off with a question and a super chat from Rob Hawk. Are there any sci-fi novels where the aliens are made of photons and travel at light speed?
Yes, although the one that comes to mind is actually the Photino boards, which are made of dark matter in Stephen Bachtor's Rift and ZD sequence.
Albert Jackinson, what effects would technologies for super soldiers have on civilians? The quick answer.
Probably about the same. I think in that episode we said the best way to make super soldiers make super citizens. But anything that enhances your strength, intelligence, reflexes, that's going to be huge in the personal lives and for civilians too.
Ed Lippincott, do you think that we will ever practically apply any exotic forms of matter like strange, quirk, exotic, or magnetic monopoles, or will they just be kept to the realms of labs?
I hope so, but my suspicion is that probably not. You think about it, if we don't have any matter made out of strange particles existing that we know aware of, so it probably doesn't naturally occur. It might be hard to do, but it'd be cool if we did.
Tommy Vask, what is the best snack and drink for SFIA?
Coffee, without going any coffee, period, and then, I don't know.
Coffee with chocolate.
Coffee with chocolate. Yeah, there's so many good things out of chocolate.
Amen.
Yeah.
Astronomer KSP, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your favorite color of the alphabet? I think I misread that. No, it says, what's your favorite color of the alphabet?
Well, that's deep. What's my favorite color of the alphabet? My favorite color of the alphabet. Green. Green. We're going to go with green. I'm trying to remember what that is, like kinesthesia or something like that, where you could start smelling sounds or vice versa.
Can you smell that sound?
It was if you have brain damage or sometimes, then you can start smelling sounds or hearing colors.
Okay, moving on to Dance 5. Is it possible to use a 10-mile cable from a geostationary space station to lift satellites into space from Earth?
A 10-mile?
Well, that's what it said.
Geostationary is like 26,000 miles from the Earth's surface. I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on what was the actual question? It could have been, what's my favorite color of the alphabet?
That's what the text said, so we're sticking with that.
I'm sure there was a question out there that one broke my brain. There
All
you
right,
go.
ready? That one was the stump question. Here's another one. Navis Noblight, if we harness the power of your beard, can we power a Nyker Dyson beam without using the sun?
Possibly, yes. Possibly. There is a reason why the mustache is gone temporarily, by the way, so you'll be back soon.
Daniel James, hi Isaac, is it possible that we could build remotes for opening wormholes into different realities, like in that 90s show Sliders for colonizing an Exer?
Sliders was an interesting TV show. I eventually ended up becoming like some kind of Cro-Magnon mutant race that ate people. It was like the big bad, like season two or three. I don't see the multiverse thing actually working out, but if you could, there's so many more cool things you could do than run around from different versions of almost the exact same planet with the same history, but still had some good episodes.
Sean Bourne, do you think that humanity will terraform Venus? And if so, do you think that plate tectonics could be initiated artificially?
Yes and yes. I don't see us really disposing of any of the main planets. I think we'd be more likely import them elsewhere. So they're the original ones. We're going to keep them.
Do you think that aliens would have an appearance reflecting the strength of their planet?
An appearance reflecting the strength of their planet? Like the gravitational strength? Or
maybe like Klingons.
Yeah. Could be. I don't think gravity's not going to vary much, I think, on planets that people are natively from. So, yeah, but your planet's going to be huge on impacting how you come out of things. You're just going to be so impacted by that.
Fate's End. Oops, ad. Sorry, got an ad.
While we're waiting for that ad to clear on the phone.
Here it is. Fate's End. What is the largest number naturally habitable planets that you could reasonably fit inside the habitable zone of a sun-like star? And another ad.
Somebody said like, you could do like 1,000 in there. Before I actually did the channel, and I just get bored and see how many real planets you could put around there, I figured out a way to put in one. It was actually had a sun that had suns around it too, each of their own solar system clouds. That one I think I worked out to have like 1 billion habitable planets around one star, or maybe it was 1 trillion. It was smaller than a Borch planet, but much bigger than Dyson's wheel.
John Sterriman, are Jupiter or Saturn's moons better candidates for colonization?
Going back to the other one, the limitation was how many planets of Earth mass could fit into a space inside like 10,000 AU or 100,000 AU, and that one did work out to be, I want to say it was around 1 trillion Earth masses. So that was the number. What was the question again?
I don't know.
Someone finally got a question there and I got lost because I got distracted on a rabbit trail.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to find the additional ones, but I think that we actually butted up against our time. It's officially 5:01.
Oh, Jupiter or Saturn's moons better candidates for colonization. I got the side screen. See, it came in handy for a change.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's like 3 models over there, and in case I could look at them. Oh, Jupiter or Saturn's moons better candidates for colonization. Without the radiation issue, yeah, I would say they're better than some of the other options out there. But Jupiter I like better than Saturn because Saturn's only got that one big moon, Titan, which is easier to colonize than those 4. But I definitely say the Galilean moons as a whole represent a better score, as it were. Any of those places, you're not going to be walking around the open air with the sky and the sunshine down here. So it kind of varies. So for those who have joined us next week, thank you for joining us. We will all say goodbye and we'll see you Thursday for that episode. I can't remember what the episode is going
to
be.
We'd like to give a shout out. Thank you again, Maya Skill, for keeping us up to date on the questions and pulling them. It definitely helps, and it makes the lightning round a lot more fun. Thank you all for your quick
Discord
questions.
Hanger, you should probably send him a note if you ever want to help on the modding because he's kind of stuck to himself at the moment. So thank you very much, and thank you, Em, for joining us today, and we will see you on Thursday for episode that I still can't remember the name of. It's probably on the screen. Small Titties. We'll see you on Thursday for Smart Cities. Thank you, and we'll see you then.
Have a great week.
Thank you for joining us for another monthly live stream. If we missed any of your questions, feel free to put them in the comments on the episode, and we'll see you on Thursday. But if you don't want to wait, you can check out any of this month's recent episodes or see our bonus content over on Nebula at go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur. As always, thanks for watching, and have a great week.